Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Thursday, December 14, 2023. The U.S. State Department says riot abuses committed during Sudan's ongoing conflict must be prosecuted.
The ICC Prosecutor's Office has announced that it has commenced focused investigations onto recent events. The international community must work together towards meaningful justice for victims and affected communities and bring an end to this long era of impunity.
And a recent report reveals shrinking media freedom and attacks against journalists amid Sudan's current conflict.
After 7 months, we have 4 journalists killed during this war. 30 have been injured while they are covering the war. And hundreds of journalists take refuge across the borders to neighboring countries.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. State Department conducted a virtual press briefing this morning regarding Secretary Antony Blinken's determination last week that Sudan's both of Sudan's warring parties, the army and the rapid support forces, have committed war crimes in their ongoing conflict. Blinken also said the RSF was involved in ethnic cleansing in Darfur. Beth Van Schaak, U.S. Department of State Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice, addressed journalists in Washington.
The secretary made this determination to bear witness to and to shine a light on the abuses suffered by the Sudanese people at the hands of the very forces who are meant to protect them. We also hope to rally the international community to help us end the violence, address the humanitarian crisis, and promote justice for survivors and victims. In the State Department and across the U.S. government, we will continue to track and document the scope and breadth of the belligerents' myriad crimes.
Schaak noted the work done by Sudanese and regional journalists and rights defenders in documenting the crimes.
I really want to acknowledge the important work that journalists have done in this case. They have not been deterred by the violence on the ground, and so we really appreciate particularly some of the regional media centers to continue to cover these issues. For too long in Sudan, perpetrators have killed, raped, and attacked civilians with impunity. The atrocities occurring today in Darfur are an ominous reminder of the prior genocide from the early 2000s, in that they involve so many of the same perpetrators, the same communities being targeted, and the same patterns of criminality.
She emphasized that riots, abuses, and war crimes occurring in Sudan's conflict must be prosecuted to end impunity for rights violations in the country.
The United States applauded the recent announcement that alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity committed during the current fighting may be subject to investigation and prosecution before the International Criminal Court. The ICC Prosecutor's Office has announced that it has commenced focused investigations onto recent events. The international community must work together towards meaningful justice for victims and affected communities and bring an end to this long era of impunity.
She urged all states to cooperate with the investigation, adding that continued documentation will be critical to laying the groundwork for accountability efforts.
The U.S. government has worked closely with key allies to establish a new Sudan-focused fact-finding mission at the Human Rights Council. This new mechanism will be able to gather evidence of atrocities nationwide and begin to establish responsibility for their commission. We have also funded, through our Conflict and Stabilizations Organization, a new Sudan Conflict Observatory that's based at Yale University. The United States will also continue to support Sudanese-led documentation efforts, particularly those that are survivor-centered and trauma-informed.
Both of Sudan's warring parties, the Sudan Armed Forces, or SAF, and the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, have denied accusations of war crimes in their 8-month-long conflict, which has killed more than 12,000 people and displaced over 6 million. A As fighting rages on in Sudan, a report by the United Nations Cultural Agency UNESCO highlights shrinking media freedoms in the country. The report shows journalists in Sudan experience gross rights violations, including rape and torture, forcing dozens of them to flee to neighboring countries, including Uganda. Mugumi Davis Rakarinj has this report from Kampala.
A report entitled, Instead of Violence, the Pressing Needs of Sudanese Journalists, released last month, says 90 of the 200 journalists interviewed faced either psychological or physical violence. Abdumonel Idris is president of Sudanese Journalists Syndicate and spoke to VOA from Al Jazeera State near Madan by phone.
After 7 months, we have 4 journalists killed during this war. 30 have been injured while they are covering the war. And hundreds of journalists take refuge across the borders to neighboring countries, to Egypt, to South Sudan, to Uganda, to Kenya, to Chad, even to Saudi Arabia.
Another Sudanese journalist, Othman Obeid, who now lives in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, says he was forced to flee for his life when violence broke out in Khartoum in mid-April.
In Sudan, everyone's security and life got affected by the ongoing conflict. I don't think there's a single newspaper that is still operational in Sudan right now. I left Khartoum on the 30th day of the conflict because I was residing very close where it was started.
Jay Wegener is the director of International Fellowship at the German-based NGO Media in Cooperation and Transition, which conducted the research.
So many journalists we spoke to have experienced assault. They've been held at gunpoint, arrested just for simply carrying out their work. For women, we have unfortunately also seen multiple reported cases of sexual assault and rape, causing some of them to no longer even leave their homes.
Wegener says the fighting between the Sudan Army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has also led to economic hardships, forcing 43% of journalists to take up unpaid jobs, while hundreds more work for less than $100 per month, which is not enough to provide for themselves or their families. She also says journalists also faced cyber intimidation and threats. As a result, Wegener says many journalists resort to some form of self-censorship or quit the profession altogether.
Ultimately, with some content carrying this immediate death threat, it is understandable that some may pause their professional work.
The report recommends that journalists relocate to safer places and be provided with psychological and financial assistance. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
A pilot labor market survey in South Sudan confirms that there is a huge youth unemployment gap in the country. The Labor Ministry launched a labor market information system today, which is aimed at providing the government, aid agencies, and the private sector with labor market and migration information needed for planning. Charlton Doke reports for VOA from Juba.
The findings of the pilot survey were announced during the launch of the Labour Market Information System, or LMIS. The International Organization for Migration is funding the project. Speaking at the launch of the system in Juba earlier today, John McHugh, the IOM Chief of Mission in South Sudan, said the pilot survey shows some important labour market information.
After interviewing 127,000 youth, we see that the youth unemployment rate is 72% for men and 88.6% for women, which is a definite concern for the economy and stability of this country. We also saw how there were a large number, 1,000 plus university graduates, that are another 7,000 with secondary school certificates and over 27,000 without formal education. All of this helps us to determine policy recommendations on what issues to address.
The LMIS is a tool to collect, analyze, and disseminate labor market information for use in development. It consists of a set of mechanisms designed to produce labor market information and identify skills demands and the supply of labor. It is a system designed to support the government, aid agencies, and the private sector as they seek to hire workers. Brian Chiberu, a consultant who helped design the labor market information system, says the survey confirms that unemployment remains high in South Sudan.
And what we already see here is that we have a huge youth unemployment gap in the country, we have high unemployment in the country, but also there is effort to create more jobs. The manufacturing sector is a major employer within the sector. Trade and transportation and storage in other sectors is employing so many people, but also development partners employ. We have more migrants coming in, mainly from DRC, Uganda, Sudan, that are coming in here. And of course, we see we have a huge difference between gender, with more men employed than women. And even in terms of salaries, we see men earning more than women.
At the event, Hussein Abdulbaghi, the vice president in charge of the government service delivery cluster, said in the past, weak institutions, a lack of resources and a lack of data hindered policy formulation and monitoring. That hindered development efforts.
I believe that the system will support the government, private sector and partners to South Sudan to understand South Sudan labor market engagement to match the supply and demand of the labor. There is no any means for the government of South Sudan to improve the state of human development but through labor market information system. Therefore, we need LMIS in order to identify policies and design programs that will encourage human resources development and support in employment growth over the long term. In addition, students and job seekers need labor market information system to help them to develop career plans, make career choices, obtain information about training opportunities, and find jobs.
Abdulbaghi says the system will help students and job seekers develop career plans, obtain information about training opportunities, and find jobs. Julius Tabule Daniel is South Sudan's Deputy Minister of Public Service and Human Resource Development. He says the LMIS will help the government plan better.
It has provided us that small hole through which we can see how South Sudan looks like in terms of employment, who are employed, who are not employed. Now, that will help government to plan accordingly. It will help government to formulate policies that will address some of those challenges which are being faced in the labor market.
The pilot survey was conducted in 6 payams of Juba County in Central Equatoria State. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the resolutions of the just-concluded COP28 summit in the United Arab Emirates and their implications for oil-producing Nigeria. Stay tuned.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1-202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1-202-630-8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. World leaders and representatives from nearly 200 nations attending the COP28 climate summit in Dubai reach a landmark deal to transition away from fossil fuels. The deal is receiving a less than hearty welcome in Nigeria, which depends on crude oil sales for most of its budget, and where leaders say they need funding if the world wants the country to transition away from the use and production of fossil fuels. Timothy Obiezo reports.
The COP28 climate summit closed in Dubai Wednesday with the signing of a deal to transition away from oil, gas and coal in what the text called a, quote, just, orderly and equitable manner, end quote, in hopes of reducing carbon emissions and ease global warming. It is the first such agreement to move away from fossil fuels since the annual conferences began nearly three decades ago. The deal also seeks to triple renewable energy capacity globally by 2030 and promote carbon capture technologies that can help clean up hard-to-decarbonize industries. The president of the COP28, Dubai's Sultan Al-Jaber, praised the deal but said it was implementation that would signal true success. Peter Tarfa, former climate change director at Nigeria's Federal Ministry of Environment, agrees.
This is not the first time that decisions have been taken in the climate change discussions at the Conference of Parties that they have not been fully implemented. But it is actually in the best interest of the climate that all hands should be on deck.
But some are not so pleased with the deal. Members of the OPEC oil-producing countries, including Nigeria, initially resisted calls by more than 100 nations for stronger measures like a complete phase-out of fossil fuels. Salisu Dahiru is the director of Nigeria's National Council on Climate Change. He attended a plenary session in Dubai Wednesday.
There's no fairness, there's no justice, there's no equity in the so-called decision to ask developing countries or to ask African countries whose emissions is a mere 3% to start ditching fossil fuel. They are being hypocritical. The same countries that are combating for this, who are they? US, EU. And this fossil fuel is necessary for developing countries to also taste the goodness of development. What we've always stood for is decarbonizing the oil and gas so that we get cleaner fuels.
Critics argue the technology is expensive and a diversionary tactic by countries to continue to produce fossil fuels. Oil accounts for 95% of Nigeria's foreign exchange earnings. Tarfa says authorities must begin to look elsewhere to grow Nigeria's economy.
There's a lot of investments now going on towards the green economic pathway. For Nigeria, yes, we cannot act in isolation. Even though the phase out or the phase down of the fuel consumption will definitely impact the economy. But now the time has come for the government to start diversifying to other sources.
Nigerian President Bola Tinubu, writing a column for CNN that was published Wednesday, said Nigeria had initiated programs to transition from fossil fuels, but that the country needs $10 billion every year until 2060 to achieve its transition plan. Tinubu also criticized developed nations for failing to honor a pledge to give $100 billion to poorer countries to mitigate the effects of climate change. Still, experts say the COP28 deal could be a turning point for the world if the political will and money are found to achieve the goals that were set. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
A court in Senegal has ordered the jailed opposition leader Ousmane Sonko be reinstated on the electoral register, paving the way for him to run in February's presidential election. Sonko has faced several court cases on various charges in recent years, all of which he denies. He always said he is the victim of a campaign to prevent him from running for the presidency. He ran in the 2019 presidential elections, coming in third. President Macky Sall has said he will not stand for re-election following speculations that he would seek an unconstitutional third term. Yahya Suhaib has more.
The appeal court, known as the Apex Court in Dakar, this morning ruled out in favor of Mr. Ousmane Sonko to be reinstated in the election list. You can recall just about, 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court took the matter. The Apex Court in Dakar ruled in favor of jail opposition leader Mr. Sonko that he should be reinstated in the electoral roll.
Sonko, who is a very popular among Senegal's large population of unemployed youth, has undergone a meteoric political rise in the last few years. Talk to us a little bit about who is Ousmane Sonko.
Yes, Ousmane Sonko is a great phenomenon in Senegal because he's also one of the most the greatest and the most popular politician in the history of Senegal. He has a large followers, as you have said, among, you know, employed youth. And he said that he got a big project for the youth so that whenever, he happened to be a president, the resources of this country can go back to the people, especially on employment. He would address that. He would address health, education, security. So many people are following him because they have great hopes in him. And they are expecting that whenever he is elected as president, the course of this country will change for the betterment of the ordinary citizen, especially those who live in the countryside.
So his party, the Patriots of Senegal Party, which was formed in 2014, has also gained political momentum.
Yes, right now there are so many, bottlenecks. In front of Mr. Sonko, as you have said, he is still jailed. He is still in prison. Most of his supporters, some of the party bigwigs, they are also in jail, like his deputy Bassirou Faye, who he designated just a few weeks ago that he is going to run instead if he cannot run. We are working on how this thing is going to evolve in the next few days, in the 6 months. It is a very busy time. By the politicians, they are all going countrywide tour. They are all trying to get, nomination papers. And the period for accepting these nomination papers will be on the 26th of this month. So we'll see now what is going to happen to Mr. Sonko, whether he is going to be, because he is going to be now reinstated. So we are saying that maybe this time around the government is not going to appeal against this court ruling. We are just going to wait and see what is now going to happen in the coming days, in the coming weeks, and before these nomination papers will be closed.
And lastly, Alpha, how is the mood in Dakar? How is the mood in Senegal right now because of the news?
Yes, around the court vicinity this morning, it was electric. Sonko supporters came in large numbers early in the morning, and you've been seeing when the verdict was, just pronounced, there was dancing. His lawyers also, they were very happy. One of them met Credo Lee. I saw him. He was laughing. He was clapping. So this, because they said that they have done well, they have represented Mr. Sonko well. So that right now they are going to see whether the government this time will respect, the court decision, because previously a subordinate court which ruled in favor of Mr. Sonko was never being respected by the state. So they are saying that hopefully this time Mr. Sonko will be reinstated in the election list, and he will be allowed to contest in the forthcoming presidential election slated on the 25th of February 2024.
The Biden administration's support for Israel in the war against Hamas has drawn sharp criticism both from Americans protesting Palestinian civilian deaths and from State Department staff calling for a ceasefire. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden has been signaling to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he needs a change of course or risk international standing. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
For decades, the United States has sought to mediate the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians over land, control of religious sites, and sovereignty. In 1993, a promising moment at the White House when Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Palestine Liberation Organization negotiator Mahmoud Abbas signed a declaration on self-government, commonly referred to as the Oslo Accords. Peace appeared close at hand, but the Palestinians ended up violating the agreement, according to former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Korb, who witnessed the signing. Korb, now a senior fellow with the Center for American Progress, tells VOA he still believes in a two-state solution, but under a new Palestinian leadership.
Now, the Palestinians got to get their act together. You know, their leader, Mahmoud Abbas, he's out of it. He's too old. He can't, you know, be effective. They have to get another leader, too. And if you can get a separate Palestinian state out of this horrible situation, that will be really a significant achievement and will make it much easier to maintain stability in the region.
Aaron David Miller worked for Republican and Democratic administrations for decades, often as part of the U.S. team trying to negotiate peace in the Middle East. He sees more continuity than change in U.S.-Israeli relations, especially with President Joe Biden in the White House. Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow for American statecraft at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
For Joe Biden, alone among modern American presidents, he considers himself literally part of the Israeli story. His relationship with Israeli prime ministers and other leaders goes back decades. I mean, he insisted on going into a war zone when this crisis first broke.
Biden embraced Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu just days after members of the U.S.-designated terrorist group Hamas killed 1,200 Israelis and took more than 200 others hostage in the brutal October 7th attack. He has repeatedly said the United States will always be there for Israel. But in 2 months, Israel has pounded the Hamas-run Gaza Strip, displacing at least 2 million Palestinians, wounding more than 50,000 people, and killing thousands more in the bloodiest campaign in the decades-long conflict. Biden recently told an audience of political donors that Israel is losing support from other countries because of its indiscriminate bombing of Gaza, and that Netanyahu should change his hardline government. In New York and other cities, thousands of Americans have taken to the streets to protest the killing of Palestinian civilians in Israel's offensive against Hamas. Some White House and State Department staff also have strong feelings about the conflict, with some signing letters of protest and even resigning from the administration. Elizabeth Shackelford is a former career diplomat who wrote a book about her experiences called The Dissent Channel. She is now a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs.
People on the inside of the State Department have been watching our policy towards Israel, you know, for many years, for decades in some case. And we've largely had unconditional military support for Israel. So there's an understanding on the inside that we have not used tools that we have available, using the leverage that we have with our military support to press Israel to do more to address the Palestinian issue.
And while many have demonstrated against Israel's offensive, thousands of Americans also turned out in Washington in mid-November to support Israel and condemn anti-Semitism. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
And that's all we have for you this Thursday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. On behalf of our producer, Gwen Uten, and engineer, Bill Andrade, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. And we leave you now with Magic System and the song Premier Gaou. J'y vais pas.